But it's time to bring in David Tarachuk. It's time for the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday. We rebroadcast the Media Beat also during the weekend and also next week during our noontime news block as well. And there's always something, it seems, to talk about in the Media Beat. Good morning, David.
Well, it's good to be with you again.
Well,
I speak as a as a dual citizen, as you know, and sometimes it's a useful fact that I am both an American citizen and a European Union citizen. At least I am until the end of today, because as a Brit, I will no longer be part of the European Union. I'm no longer a European citizen. I'm a different kind of dual citizen entirely. I'm United States of America and Britain. Are the two countries which I'm a citizen of. So it feels like a limiting kind of day for me. The horizons are shrinking around me.
Now explain this. I had a couple of calls this morning and an email. So they're out of Brexit completely. And I said, well, no, they've
well, still... not exactly. Yeah. You're right to say no.
Yeah. Yeah. Not yet.
Not quite yet. We're legally and officially out at the end of today. But yes, untangling of our actual practical relationships will take some time, probably about a year, it seems.
And do you think that... Great Britain will have all its treaties set up and everything set up in that year? Because if it's anything like setting up for Brexit, this looks like a several-year job to me.
Yeah, getting out this far has taken 3 years. That's kind of an avoidable matter of record now. I caught you a telling headline from the Economist today, Britain's leading political analysis magazine, I'd say, and one much, much regarded in America. It sells more in America, I think, than it sells in its own home country. The Economist says today, wonderful headline on a editorial article, it says, a weakened post-Brexit Britain looks to America, dash. Good luck with that.
That's right. Well, what an opportune...
A judicious assessment of the situation.
What an opportune time for Donald Trump to want to redo the trade agreement.
Absolutely. It's not as if Britain's going to be in a strong bargaining position, which is what, of course, Britain always wants in the world. And for many Brexiteers, it was... It's hard to credit this, but many of them really did believe that there would be a stronger bargaining entity if they bargained from their own account rather than as part of the 28 countries in the European Union bloc.
And what's interesting is...
It's no accounting for people's beliefs sometimes.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you look at this, the domino... This is the first domino finally... Well, actually, this is the second domino. The first domino was the vote to exit the European Union. Now the second domino has been knocked over. And there are so many more dominoes to be knocked over. And one of the biggest one is that problem with Ireland and the border dispute up there. I mean, that is something that's going to become a very big story now over the next, year?
I fear so. Yeah, absolutely. we will have to see how it works out. But the arrangements that Johnson made with Europe that were different from his predecessors and which enabled him to cast it in a whole new light and go to the country with it, go to a national general election and get returned with a very strong majority, based on the idea of a different kind of border arrangement between North Ireland, which of course stays within Britain, and the rest of Ireland, which stays within Europe. There are all sorts of mumblings going on, sort of discussions that are as yet not very clear about how the fuzzy state of that border is to be maintained. Some suggestion, for instance, that it will become a kind of buffer zone rather than an actual hard border. Other and more concrete arrangements are being made to ensure that customs checks for goods going into Northern Ireland that might end up in southern Europe, still European Ireland, will be regulated in crossing the water between the island of Britain and the island of Ireland. It's all got to be worked out in the, you know, as they say, the devil is in the details, and these details will have to be worked out in practice. But the fear is still there. It's not been removed by Boris's sleight of hand, as I heard one politician describe it. It's not changed. The basic problem is that there will still be some form of regulation of passage of goods across that border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And however minimal they are likely to become targets for Republican extremists. That is, people who want Ireland completely united and entirely independent of Britain. And we know how that went over the 20 to 30 years of violence in Northern Ireland, which, of course, impinged upon both Southern Ireland and the United Kingdom's mainland, Britain, bombing campaigns that wrought terrible carnage. And the fear, of course, is that we'll be taking a step backward toward that horrible situation.
Let's take a worldview here. It seems like countries just don't learn their lesson. It's a pretty small world right now. We'll go to Iran first, where they had to admit very quickly that they did shoot down their own airliner in that missile crisis. But
a Ukrainian airliner
yeah.
from their own capital. Yes.
Yeah, and there's that, and then there's also what's happened in China with this virus outbreak. You can't keep things now because there's so much travel and there's so much interaction with the what's called the global economy that China really did everybody a disservice by not letting the WHO in until, well, I think it was 2 days ago. And now you've got a situation that looks a lot like it could be even bigger than the SARS crisis that we went through many, many years ago, which really impacted Hong Kong.
Sure, and that overall global phenomenon you're talking about is not just trade and practical interactions. It's the information world we live in now too, that revolutionized, of course, by the internet. And the states can't keep things secret in the way that they used to be able to. Iran may have gotten away with that. Well, for a lot longer, maybe, that first denial that they had anything to do with the shooting down of a Ukrainian airliner, full of Iranians and Canadians and other nationalities, of course. They would not have been able to keep that a secret the way that they can't keep it a secret now, I'm saying, in a way that they might possibly have been able to do earlier in our informational history. It is a small world in that sense, as you say, and more and more authoritarian regimes in particular are having to cope with the fact that so much of what they do comes to light in a way that it never used to do, or at least very much more quickly. And of course, you know, they are taking as they would in the spirit of self-protection that all autocrats have, all totalitarian regimes have, that they will use this new open forum in which we all get to know each other's business so clearly and so quickly, and turn it into something that they can weaponize themselves. And so inevitably you get China's efforts to interfere with our Americas, that is, America's electoral processes, its power grid, potentially, and that kind of thing. And of course, the Iranians, too, are known to be very active in the cybersphere. And of course, the big specialist in this area has been Russia so far. They will continue to make their efforts to interfere with other people's information systems and everything that depends upon information systems. IT is king in many ways. If you manage to get hold of other people's IT, you're in a very powerful position.
All right. So now we look at the world at a glance, and we unfortunately have to come back into this country and take a look at what's going on in Washington, D.C. And you know, when when this whole process started of impeaching the president, I told everybody that. Everybody expected me to go crazy on my Facebook page. I said, I'm not going to say anything until it's all over. And it's very close to being all over. But what's interesting to me is that the media, in this case, tried to work something, and I don't think it was a successful look. I mean, with the minute this got to the Senate, we all knew that, yes, the president was impeached by the House, and we all knew that there's just never, ever going to be enough votes to convict in the Senate. I mean, everybody knew that going in. And the media just doesn't seem to give up on, I'm not saying all the media, but some of the media, about trying to keep hopes alive of witnesses and a vote on the impeachment. It's basically was a done deal, just like when Bill Clinton was impeached by the House. It was basically a done deal. There was no way he was going to be convicted in the Senate. The stain of being impeached by the House is a stain that will stay on people's records. But I'm just amazed at how the media in this country really tried to build this Senate portion up, where everything pointed to the direction in which it basically headed, which was two parties giving two different stories, and the majority party will basically rule the day in that portion of our House in the Senate. I mean, how do you look at what has transpired here?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's a done deal. And here we are on Friday, the 31st of January. It's not only Brexit Day for Europe, it's for America. It's it's the last day in which the Senate is, not necessarily the absolute last day, but it's the day we've been anticipating all this time, that a vote may well be taken on whether the impeachment process goes any further. This could be the day that the president is acquitted. And that, everybody has known, was looming all along. You're quite right. But the media's been trying to have it both ways. They'll say that they'll keep reminding us that impeachment is not a judicial procedure as such. It's a political procedure. And, of course, politics and certainly an elected bodies like the Senate and indeed the House of Representatives is a matter of numbers, how many numbers each side has, and that makes it a done deal before it happens. There was some possibility as we came towards this final stage of the process that there may be enough Republicans who would cross the line and vote with the Democrats in wanting, for instance, to have more witnesses called. I wouldn't have witnesses called at all in the Senate after the House had been calling witnesses all the time. Yeah, and also to subpoena documents. And it needed four Republicans to do that. And one of those four now, his Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, has said very clearly that he's not going to join the Democrats in asking for or demanding subpoenaing any witnesses. So the likelihood of more witnesses being called and the impeachment process going any further is as you say, quashed at this point. But the other thing, interestingly, that Lamar Alexander said, is that the Democrat House managers, the prosecutors in this case, as it were, have made their case very convincingly. He believes that everything that they say that the president has done, he has done. He just thinks that it doesn't rise to actual level of impeachable high crime or misdemeanor. So that takes us back to the heart of the conundrum that's going on here. As you say, we know in all in 99% probability that he will not be removed from office. That's very clear. So, yes, legal versus political, that's what we're facing here. And it's been quite clear, of course, that, you know, just politics being a matter of numbers in elected bodies, of course, representative bodies like the U.S. Congress, both houses, it's a matter of who's got the votes. And the Republicans were looking like they could possibly lose maybe 4 votes, and that's not clearly not going to happen now. So the whole thing could be wrapped up today. So as well as Brexit Day, it could be Trump acquittal day. But except that, you know, given the Senate's propensity for wanting to, you know, be in the public eye, they may stretch it out in some ways, but the actual meat of the process is probably going to be over today. But the what has gone on in the interim, the media have been trying to play it both ways. They've been keep reminding us that this is a political process and not a legal one in the end. But they do seem to have gotten hung up on the legalities of it. And that, of course, is entirely understandable, not only because it makes better copy and more compelling, or for some people anyway, more compelling broadcasting. It's also a matter of fact, proceeding to make their case, believing that they can sway the jury, as in a real court. And of course, say, we all know that's not the case, and yet they've gone through the motions. And dutifully enough, the media have gone through the motion, the reporting of those motions. And conveniently enough for the media, it also provides the fodder for creating drama, which, of course, the media thinks is the main way to approach any story if they want to compel viewers, listeners, and readers.
You know, if I want to tie two together, I'll tie this together. I think the Democrats have been stupid to fight this. They've presented their case. They presented their facts. They should have just gotten on to the vote, because in between now and Election Day, there's going to be plenty of bombshells that they don't even have to drop. They're out there from different people, Bolton and everybody else, and that's going to become part. And they can keep, by the way, they can keep their committees investigating. So I don't know why the Democrats wanted to stretch this out, but I'll turn this over now. And Joe pointed this out to me via text, when you take a look at Brexit, you look at Boris Johnson, who just had an outstanding, huge victory. Well, now over the course, over the course of the next year, are they going to have a hard exit? Are they going to have the economy, the long range view is very shaky, and I tie both them together. I mean, the short term view right now looks like there's okay, Brexit is over, okay, the impeachment is over, but now comes the long term view of this. Just basically, this is like the beginning of a tsunami. The water has now been sucked out, sooner or later the water is going to come back in.
Oh yeah, but this is what I was waiting for the two of you to get to as I was listening. Enthusiastically. And that is short-term versus long-term. We've had three examples this week, of information that got out long before it should have, because everybody's just in such a raging hurry. And it's not in a raging hurry to be first. It's flat sloppiness. And one was the ABC national correspondent who erroneously reported that the entire Bryant family was in the helicopter. One was the Chazarai about the tweet from the Washington Post. And the other was more local to us, where Fotis Doulos, who has been in the news since the disappearance of his wife on the 24th of May, was declared With a drone. Thank you very much.
They declared him dead, but worse, David. I don't know if you followed the story. They sent drones over his house while the EMS was still working on him, and it was so bizarre that they had to set up tents to work on him.
The kind of tents that you have at craft fairs.
That just went so far over the bounds.
You know, it's just it was, and for what, to be wrong? I mean, yeah, the guy. In other words, my point here is there's a process, just as there's a process. Yes, it's officially Brexit Day, all right. Yes, but it's going to be a lot of hard and political work, which means that it will never the objections will never cease, because that's what politics essentially is.
I liken Brexit and
people attempting things and other people objecting. Yeah.
I liken Brexit and the impeachment to an earthquake. And now an earthquake has occurred in both situations. Now let's see what happens after the earthquake is over. Does a tsunami come in or does a tsunami not come in? The waters are totally now uncharted as to what's going to happen in both cases over the next year and one over the next eight months.
And so what I'm fascinated by, because this is, in my view, again, for what it's worth, an inflection point for the grown-ups to retake control of the so-called press, because there's a real opportunity to report, you know, sorry to say this, to report things rather than opine about what it is that you think you're about to be reporting on. This is a real opportunity.
We devoutly wish for that. We devoutly wish for that all the time, that the media would stop this constant headlong gathering swine kind of a rush into forming opinions rather than checking the facts. I mean, all the three the story points that you make, the rumbling news of the last week, they're all examples of editorial teams getting way ahead of themselves. The simple and most basic element of reporting, which is checking the facts, for heaven's sake. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And as we look at the prospects ahead of us, I'll continue with your metaphor. We're past the earthquake, the actual shaking of our institutions now. But what happens now? Do buildings crumble, or do they stand solidly and withstand the inevitable aftermath? But we're living we're now in both those areas, both Brexit and the survival or otherwise of the Trump administration. Pressures and aftermath consequences of what's been going on previously, and that's only right in the case of presidential. Make up their minds about what's been going on in the first 4 years, Trump being in power, and everyone to take stock, and let's hope that people take it seriously, and the media bears, of course, primary responsibility for deciding whether or not the public take things seriously, and we'll see how it goes. But I'm afraid the performance so far is not encouraging. Breathlessness. Yeah, I'm breathless myself. There's a breathlessness to it all that. It doesn't serve the purpose, and it's not fit for purpose at all. And we need, as Jill's saying, a whole new approach to this final, very important 11 months or so.
And I just want to quickly add, because our connection is feeble, in the interest of that, I would recommend two things. I am sure you noticed the new aggregator service that was launched by Mr. Murdoch, and which is quite interesting. And I was even more interested to discover that he is launching a radio station. And I thought, well, that's good, because we're a little on, we're ahead on this one. They're big,
we're
small.
Right-wing radio, aren't we?
Well, it's not that. It's just the realization. You know, from a strictly business standpoint, one has to look back and go, okay, look what he got rid of. Look what they divested themselves of. And now look what they're doing. They kept sports. And now they're doing aggregate, which is, you know, perfect. And then your own radio. So it's like...
Low cost, high return effort, yeah.
Yep.
And you may not agree that that's always true for radio. It is, in some ways, a low-cost, high-return business. It should not surprise us. But in the shape of 21st century Fox, I guess we call it now, they've obviously been very canny, as the Murdoch family always have been.
Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, the Media Beat.